Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Kirk Pittard from Dallas with law firm of Durham, Pittard & Spaulding. Kirk, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you all for having me.
Well, your name shows up in a lot of court opinions. I know you're a very experienced appellate practitioner here in our state. For those who don't know you, how about you introduce yourself and give a little background, a little flavor for who you are and where you come from?
I went to law school at Baylor. While I was in law school at Baylor, I did the mock trial team, moot court, and all that kind of stuff. I also clerked for Amarillo Court of Appeals and the Mississippi Supreme Court, and that's kind of when I got a taste for appellate law. Once I graduated from Baylor, I did a stint with the Dallas Court of Appeals working for Justice Jim Mosley. Worked for him for a year. Then after that, I worked for a firm over the Mid-Cities area. It was in Bedford at the time called Adams, Lynch & Lofton. And I was there for about a year and a half. And then I decided that I wanted to do more appellate and litigation work. From there, I went over to a large plaintiff's firm in Dallas called Waters & Krause. And over there, me and my original partner, Leighton Durham, along with Charles Siegel, we were the appellate group over there. And so when I was at Waters & Krause, we not only handled their appeals, but we also worked with their trial attorneys handling their substantive legal issues, their MSJs, their Daubert motions, their motions for remand, that kind of stuff. You know, one of the things that Leighton and I realized, not only from working there, but Leighton had also worked at the Dallas Court of Appeals too, but working at the Dallas Court of Appeals is we thought, you know, there's a lot of big firms that have in-house appellate counsel, but there's a lot of smaller to medium-sized firms that don't. And we thought, you know, those medium to smaller size firms could really use some appellate help at the trial level and in the appellate court. And so we started thinking that particularly on the plaintiff side, plaintiff's personal injury work. So back in 2003, Leighton and I left and started up Durham & Pittard at that point. And that's what we did. We focused on medium to smaller size firms, pitching our work to them as, hey, we can handle your appeals. We can also help you out with substantive motion practice at the trial level, going to trial with you, making sure errant records being preserved. And at that point, there really weren't any appellate boutiques in Dallas. Justice Hankinson, who was on the Texas Supreme Court, she had started up her appellate practice in Dallas, but she was primarily getting hired by big firms and a lot on the defense side. And so there was still an opportunity for me and Leighton to really focus on the medium to smaller size firms, particularly on the plaintiff side. And so we started doing that back in 2003. And since then, it's just grown. You know, we've been doing this for almost 20 years. We now have 11 attorneys and three offices. We have an office in Dallas, Houston. And then we, a few years ago, we started up an appellate boutique in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And the opportunities out there were great because there's really not really any appellate boutiques in New Mexico. There's some appellate practitioners, but not really an appellate boutique. So we now have three attorneys out there. We've got two in our Houston office, and then all the others are in our Dallas office.
People may not realize, but New Mexico, particularly that Santa Fe area, has a lot of personal injury litigation that goes on.
There's a lot. There's a whole lot, yeah.
Well, you mentioned having worked for Judge Mosley, and I remember way back in like 2005 or so, when I was first thinking about starting my own shop, I remember a conversation I had with Justice Mosley, and he said, you know, you really ought to talk to Pittard and Durham. You know, they're kind of doing what you're thinking about doing already. And so that's when I first recall hearing about you and getting to know you a little bit. And of course, you know, our paths have crossed a number of times over the years since then, but I've certainly looked upon your firm and admired the practice that y'all built, and you've kind of done it your way. And I think filled a very important gap, not only in terms of the sort of non-law firm appellate support, but you guys have showed up time and time again on the plaintiff side in very significant cases. And so you've definitely created a niche that I think has served y'all very well.
Well, another interesting thing about doing the plaintiff's work is we do a lot of work on a contingency fee. I would say about probably 60% of our work is contingent fee. And there's not a lot of appellate firms that do contingent work. I mean, there's some, but that was one way we were able to particularly get in on the plaintiff side with medium to smaller size firms, because they may not be able to afford to pay out of their own pocket, the trial attorneys pay out of their own pocket for, you know, an appellate attorney to be involved from beginning to end. And so we'll take that risk with them. If we, you know, we'll evaluate the case. And if it's a case we're interested in taking a risk on, we'll do that too.
Do y'all do some other alternate fee arrangements like flat fees or kind of some other stuff? I feel like you guys probably have some more flexibility than a lot of traditional firms would.
Yeah, we do. Generally speaking, we do hourly, pure contingency, and then mixed hourly contingency. And the thing that I've seen on the flat fees, and y'all may have different experiences than this than I do, unless you get that flat fee right on the number as far as what kind of time you're putting into it and what the client's paying, either you end up working too much or the client ends up paying too much. And my experience with flat fees is someone's unhappy in the end. But I know some people have done it and they've done it well and they've been successful with it. I just haven't seen it work out very well on our end.
On the mixed fees, do you kind of do a lower hourly rate and then a contingency upside at the end? Is that how that works, or just sort of a blend?
It's generally a portion of our hourly rate and then a portion of our usual contingency fee. So yeah, it's kind of half and half.
You don't have to disclose what it is, but do you go into a possible contingent fee situation with a set percentage in mind that y'all sort of use as your baseline, or is it just case by case?
What we do generally with the percentages is a lot of times we'll do a stair-stepped approach. So there's a percentage for pretrial work, percentage for when the trial starts, percentage for court of appeals, percentage for petition practice in the Supreme Court, and then percentage for merits practice in the Supreme Court. And then the other option we give is we'll tell trial attorneys, hey, you can have all, forget the stair step. If you want all that, we'll just do something, just one flat rate. So we give them a lot of different options.
Do you have any conversations with plaintiff's lawyers about adjusting their contingent fee agreements to account for appeals? I've seen a lot of plaintiff's contingent fee agreements, and a number of them will say, we just don't handle the appeal, period. And so I suppose that might leave some room for negotiation with the firm directly and perhaps with the client to carve out a contingent fee portion. Or otherwise, you know, I've seen them where they'll have a contingent fee kicker for appeal, like bump it up from, say, 40 to 45%, or I've even seen some that were 50% or so. Do you see that much in your practice?
You know, some people will have a kicker in their fee agreement with a client. And then if they don't, we just work with, you know, and it's not just trial counsel we're working with. A lot of times it's trial counsel, it's co-trial counsel, it's referring counsel. And so we'll just get them all together and say, hey, let's redistribute these points to account for our involvement in the case. And so, you know, people, trial counsel, referring counsel, whatever, will give up some points to make it work.
We've asked you to come on today to talk specifically about your experience in serving as the appellate attorney on a trial team, which is a topic that's very near and dear to our hearts because we enjoy that and think that appellate lawyers really ought to be doing that in lots of different settings. But before we jump into that, I want to make sure and ask you about your avocation of being a pilot and how you got started on that and what you're doing with these days. Because if anybody follows you on social media, they will see the occasional pittered photo in the cockpit going off somewhere, maybe not exotic. It seems like a useful way to travel the state of Texas.
You know, when I was in junior high, I think I went flying with a buddy of mine, his dad, and his small plane. I just thought, man, this is the coolest thing, you know, being up in the air, being in control of this thing. And throughout high school, I toyed with the idea of going into the Air Force Academy so I could fly jets. And then I got to Baylor and I got real involved in student government. And I thought about doing ROTC and going that route for flying. But I was so involved in student government that I thought, well, I'm just going to. My other passion is going to law school. So I'll go to law school and then I'll get my pilot's license after that so I can do both the things I'm passionate about. So the year after I graduated from law school, that was when I was working for Judge Mosley at the court. So I was working government hours. I wasn't in private practice yet. So I had an arrangement with Judge Mosley where I would leave a little bit early on Wednesdays and I'd fly Wednesday evenings and then I'd fly both Saturday and Sunday. So I got my private pilot's license in 99. And then I came back a year and a half later in 2001 and got my instrument rating. So I've been flying for 23 years now, and I fly Beach Bonanza A36. Yeah, it's a good way. Most of my travel has been work-related. If I'm traveling to hearings or to trials or to meetings, and Austin or San Antonio or Houston or New Orleans or wherever. It's a great way to be able to get around. And so I've really enjoyed that a lot. And it's actually, in some ways, it's fairly cost effective. I mean, I've had clients that they didn't want to pay for me to drive to Sweetwater. But if I could fly myself to Sweetwater and get there in a third of the time, they were like, nah, that makes a little bit more sense. It ended up saving them a little bit of money, even when I charged my travel time and for the plane. So anyway, a lot of it's work related, but it's fun. I love being up there. It's very peaceful and get some great views.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First of its kind features, like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator, expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
Well, turning back to the topic at hand about embedding in a trial team, you were a speaker at the Advanced Appellate Seminar back in December, and you presented your paper and spoke with Judge Dustin Howell, who's a previous guest of our show and a friend of the show. How did you get connected with Judge Howell to give that presentation?
Well, I was on the committee that helped plan that CLE, and so I pitched the idea because I just hadn't seen a CLE done at the Advanced Appellate Seminar where they really talked about an appellate attorney being on the trial team and what all they do and how they do it effectively. I hadn't seen it. And, you know, in my firm, with all of our attorneys working, I'd say 60% of our work is litigation support at the trial level. So it's a huge part of our practice. And so I thought it'd be a good topic. And then I can't remember who threw out Judge Howell's name, but they threw it out and said, hey, maybe y'all want to tag team this. And it just so happens that Judge Howell is a director in the Texas Lyceum. Well, I just finished 6 years, not just, but about 2 years ago, I finished a 6-year stint as a director with the Texas Lyceum. So that gave me and Judge Howell another connection so we could kind of talk Texas Lyceum stuff. But anyway, we met for the first time face-to-face when we were down there giving the CLE presentation, and we had a great time doing it. He's a great guy.
And I think that that's something that people forget about is how much time appellate attorneys actually spend in the trial court. Because you think about, oh yeah, you know, we brief appeals, we go to Supreme Courts, all that jazz. But you're right. So much of the practice really is kind of consulting or being part of the trial team or getting people ready for trial with an eye towards an appeal.
Well, I'll tell you what, and this may be y'all's experience too, but you know, the worst thing for me is when a trial attorney calls me after the case is over and they say, hey, we've got this appeal we need you to handle. And either, you know, it's some big verdict they want to hold or something they want to get reversed. And I start going through the record and I look at it and I see all the error in it. And I think if I had been involved at the trial level, I could have cleaned all this up or at least positioned it in a way that put me in a better position on appeal. And so I think for appellate attorneys, it's really important, if you can, to have a role in creating the record that you need on appeal.
Obviously, some of this is self-interested, but it really is also client-driven. The earlier, the better for that exact reason. Because if you get called, you know, hey, come to trial and all the pretrial stuff has been handled, it's all been filed, it's all been ruled upon. I mean, you can come and you can help and that's great, but a lot of times your hands are tied on things that would have been better to know about in advance. Same thing's true post-trial.
And when you mentioned the earlier, the better, this is one example that I give. When we talk about earlier, the better, I even mean before the case is filed, before your active pleadings are filed. And here's why. I recall, and this is back when we first started practicing, early 2000s, maybe, there was a personal injury case, big verdict. And it went all the way to the Texas Supreme Court. And they ended up reversing that case because it was filed in the wrong venue. Well, that's a pleading issue. You know, that's something that you got to figure out on the front end. And so you don't always have venue issues. You don't always have personal jurisdiction issues. But if you might, get an appellate attorney involved on the front end to help evaluate those things and make sure the case is filed in the right venue.
That's a great point. I've been in your shoes with the situation you've described many times where you're handed the cold record and said, here, I need you to handle this. And it just makes such a difference to be able to get in on the front end and steer around the hazards that you see because of your experience in doing this for a couple of decades that trial lawyers just don't always see. And it's amazing when you've got the person there whose job it is to spot those problems and navigate around them, how effective you can be at dealing with them. And, you know, we're certainly, the three of us are of the same mind on this. Your topic of your paper is really giving advice to the appellate lawyer who's potentially going to be embedded in the trial team. But to the extent we can advocate for those who are in a position to bring the appellate lawyer in and help with these kinds of issues on the front end, it's, you know, people I think are concerned about cost. There's some issue potentially with control of the case, perhaps a little bit of ego at stake. I think it's a very wise trial lawyer or in-house lawyer in the right situation who says, look, we've got a situation where the law maybe is unsettled, or there's been a lot, there's a conflict in the courts of appeals on a particular issue that's going to pop up in this case, say in the legal theory, for example. And here's what our exposure is, or here's what's at stake on the other side from the plaintiff's side dollar-wise. It's a good investment of time and money in cases like that to bring in somebody like you or somebody who does what we do to just make sure that the case is properly shepherded through the process. And so I'm really looking forward to kind of diving into the meat of the conversation.
Let me make one point there. When you were talking about some of the hesitancy sometimes that trial counsel has bringing in appellate counsel, one of the hurdles that I had to overcome when we first started our firm is trial counsel would sometimes be concerned that this appellate counsel coming in was going to steal their client. I always told my trial counsel, look, I don't want your client as a client. I want you as a client. And so, you know, I will communicate with the client however you want me to or not at all. I'll do it through you. But you have to reassure the trial counsel that you're not trying to poach their clients.
I've seen that over and over again and had that expressed. I think in my former practice situation, either a solo or in a boutique, it made it pretty easy to market to that, to say, look, this is what we do. We're appellate lawyers or trial support lawyers. We exist for you. In a larger firm, I think sometimes that concern kind of kicks up, but that's spot on. And I didn't mean to omit that from the list of concerns. It's real, but I think it all comes down to the relationships between the appellate lawyer, the trial lawyer, and, you know, knowing the kind of person, the kind of lawyer that appellate counsel is. And it doesn't hurt to do exactly what you said, which is just to lay it out and say, look, my relationship is with you. If I poach your client, I'm not going to have any more work coming in my door because that's the reputation I'm going to get. And so that's a great point.
It also recognizes the reality that for appellate work, there aren't that many repeat customers. There's maybe big companies that do a lot of appeals, but for the most part, your average litigant maybe will have one appeal ever. And I think particularly on the personal injury side, I'm sure that that's true. So as a business growth model, it sure doesn't make much sense to start poaching the trial attorney's clients because they're not going to send you business anymore.
One of the first points in your paper is from the appellate lawyer's perspective is to determine how your trial counsel wants you involved. So I think we're kind of segueing into that topic. What advice do you have for the appellate lawyer who's going to come into a trial team on that?
Yeah, you got to figure that out because there are some trial attorneys who just want you to ghostwrite something or research something and give them advice on something. There's other trial attorneys who want your name on the filing, at least to indicate to the world that, hey, we're taking this case seriously. We brought in appellate counsel and to, you know, let the trial judge know that appellate counsel is involved. And there's also times when trial counsel will say, hey, you do the brief, put your name on it, but I'm going to argue it. Maybe for various different reasons, client driven or whatever, they want to argue it. So you just got to figure out how they want you involved. If they want you taking lead in the trial court and making the arguments, that's one thing. If they just want you behind the scenes briefing things, that's different. And that carries all the way through trial. I mean, there are times, most of the time I'm at trial right there next to the trial attorney handling various issues that come up at trial. But there are times when trial attorneys will just say, hey, I just want you on call from your office. And I want to be able to call you and say, I need you to research something or I need you to tweak this charge or whatever and just do it from your office, but you don't need to come down. So you got to determine how they want you involved. So you know whether you're taking a lead role and being visible or whether you're kind of a behind the scenes role.
And some of that also relates to how the trial court deals with appellate counsel too, because I feel like some judges are more receptive to have an appellate counsel in there, or if it's a trial with you sitting there with your laptop open versus kind of being in the background, and it just varies court to court some too.
Yeah. And one good thing about when we did this presentation with Judge Howell, I did this, you know, he was on the state district court before a federal magistrate judge. And so I got to ask him, you know, from your perspective as a judge, both a state and a federal judge, what are your thoughts? And he was very receptive to having appellate counsel involved. And after I did that presentation, I had a lot of trial judges come up to me as I was leaving and say, hey, I appreciate that presentation because I really like having appellate counsel there, because not only are they helping their trial counsel, but they're helping me make sure I don't err.
Well, it's probably worth mentioning, it's no surprise that Judge Howell would have that attitude, given his background as being formerly in the SG's office and practicing as an appellate lawyer himself. So he's very strong on the legal issues, and I know it appreciates the advice that someone like you would bring. I was curious about, in Travis County, we have a local rule that specifically allows for a limited representation. And I've used it to kind of parachute into a case to kind of get in and out, but not get full-time committed and getting served with every pleading that ever happens in the case for the life of the case, which, you know, can be a lot. Have you seen anything like that in Dallas County or any of the other jurisdictions you've practiced in? Or if people utilize sort of that limited scope representation tool, or is it more just you show up and if you need to appear a record, you do, or maybe you don't?
I haven't seen a rule like that. How I normally would handle something like that. I mean, with e-filing these days, I'm not getting bombarded with paper. I just get emails when something gets filed, and my legal assistant's got a DPS e-file email address or something like that. So they get them and they just file stuff. And so that's pretty efficient. I don't get burdened down with mail and things like that. What I do, if I need to limit my representation, at least the primary thing I'll do is I'll put it in the fee agreement. And I'll specifically set forth the fee agreement, this very specific thing I'm being hired to do, and that's it. I haven't in the past done anything with the court to say, hey, I'm only here for this motion and then I'm out. If we get to the point where I've done my job, whatever that job is, and the trial counsel says, hey, we don't need you anymore, then sometimes we'll go ahead and go that next step of just taking our names off the service list and maybe filing something with the court to say, hey, we're withdrawing and the client's going to continue to be represented by the trial counsel or something like that. But I think you do have to protect yourself in your fee agreements, because otherwise, if you just don't, then I guess the trial attorney could require more of you than you anticipated. I guess the court might too. I mean, look, I don't want to get hauled down to court to be dealing with discovery motions. You know, that's a trial attorney job.
Absolutely.
Yep.
There may have been times in the past when I've informed a court that, hey, I'm not here to take this deposition, or that's not my role in this case. My role is different. And they usually respect that limited engagement.
Sometimes you do have to have a conversation about scope creep, though, because sometimes, and God bless them, you know, you get the trial lawyer rather that loves your work and wants to get you more involved in the case, but maybe it's a little bit more than you signed up to do.
Yeah, I've had to have that conversation a few times. You know, the discovery disputes are about, you know, whether some document's relevant or whether some witness is going to be required to testify or something like that. And that is all very fact-driven. It's driven by communications that trial counsel has had throughout litigation. And I'm not privy to all that stuff. And so I always tell my trial counsel, I'm like, you handle those things because I don't know enough about it to be able to make that argument. Now, that discovery motion, let's say, for instance, I had a case out in El Paso one time, and it was a Catholic diocese child sex abuse case. And we were trying to discover some information that diocese had on this priest. Well, they asserted in their objections to discovery, they asserted the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine, which is, you know, a constitutional issue. Well, you know, when something like that comes up, yeah, you know, we'll work on that discovery motion because we got to brief a constitutional issue to determine whether those documents are going to be producible or not. And so, you know, there's sometimes that we'll get involved in discovery if the discovery involves some substantive legal issue.
Well, and back to your point, I mean, some of that has to do with how early they get you involved too, because sometimes you may foresee some of those hurdles before the suit's even filed if you get pulled in at that point.
Or you may be tapped to work on a mandamus on one of those discovery disputes, which it is kind of helpful to have some background going in when that does happen. Well, we already talked, just thinking kind of about how an appellate lawyer gets involved in the earlier stages of the case. And we've already talked a little bit about getting involved in the pleading stage and being able to identify issues that come up there, such as venue and so forth, that, as you mentioned, can have really significant consequences in the case. I think in your presentation, you talked about taking a look at the jury charge in a very early stage of the case, which is something that we hear about. Everybody seems to agree it's a great idea, but in practice, it doesn't seem to always work out that way. Do you have conversations with your trial counsel about, hey, no, really seriously, you need to listen to what your law school professor said and actually work on a charge to kind of guide discovery and so forth?
We do. You know, I would say that, it happens very rarely that we're doing a charge at the beginning of the case, but it is smart to do because it sets forth, when you have the issues laid out in the charge, you know what the jury's going to be answering. It kind of helps inform what the discovery plan can and should be. And there's a few attorneys that I work with that'll have us do a charge early on, but it's pretty rare.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
That's been my experience too, but it is so helpful. And it's one of those things that's really worth the time, because if you know what the jury is ultimately going to be asked, it really does steer the case in a different way than just kind of developing it as you go.
And just because you prepared at the beginning doesn't mean it's not going to change. It's going to change weekly. It's going to change monthly. It's going to change throughout trial. And so it's just a starting point.
You hear the phrase in business and among high achievers, begin with the end in mind. And that's a great example of that. I mean, to me, I understand why there are limitations as far as someone coming in and hiring your firm to prepare a charge early on. Or what tends to happen more often is that the junior associate and the trial lawyer's law firm gets tasked with preparing a draft charge. And that's fine and good when it's a PJC charge. But really, when that happens, it's a matter of just developing the evidence. But the kinds of cases that the three of us get involved in, either not PJC charges or there's some nuanced legal issue that can make or break the case. And so, you know, if you can identify that nuanced legal issue early on and develop your discovery and your case strategy around it, if you're handling those kinds of cases, especially when there's a lot of dollars, it's money well spent, time well spent. I understand the resistance to it. I wish more trial lawyers would actually follow through with that, because I think it just pays so many dividends down the road. What are your next bits of advice for appellate lawyers that are embedded in the trial team?
If you get hired after suit has been filed, the first things that I ask my trial counsel, I say, I need all the active pleadings and I need all pending motions. And if there's a discovery control plan in place, particularly if we're in state court, there's discovery control plan in place. I need that so I know what deadlines are that are coming up, particularly for dispositive motions and things like that. And if you're in federal court, deadlines are different because they're going to largely be dictated by when the motions file, as far as when responses are due and things like that. Those are the things I get my arms around because, you know, if they say, well, I've got five motions that are pending, two of them are discovery motions, one's a summary judgment motion. Well, we need to initially determine whether we've got enough evidence at that point to respond to that summary judgment motion. And if not, we need to help advise the trial counsel, hey, I need some discovery on this issue, and this issue, so I'm able to respond to the summary judgment. And if the summary judgment's already been set for hearing, then we've got to get it postponed so we can get some discovery done before then. But the main thing that I'm concerned about is making sure I know what the case is about from everybody's perspective, both plaintiff and defense, what the issues are, and substantive motions that are pending, whether they're motions to dismiss, 91A state motions, or 12B federal motions. Summary judgments, or whether the case has gotten removed to federal court, we've got to do a motion for remand if there's a grounds for that. And then in anticipation of Daubert motions, you know, obviously developing a Daubert record, it can be pretty complex. And so there are a lot of times we will work with a trial counsel on the scientific issues, the causation issues, whatever, to say, look, we need this from your expert, and we need to help you develop the questions to ask this expert so that we can get the evidence that we need. So there's a little more involvement on the discovery side. There's a little more involvement when we're talking about expert discovery, because we know that's ultimately going to be an issue that we're either going to have to deal with in a Daubert motion, or we're going to have to use in response to summary judgment. So those are kind of the things I try to get my arms around initially after suit's been filed, but before trial.
And there's a lot of places in Texas, especially now, where there's interlocutory appeals, permissive appeals, mandamuses, so much more than there were 10 years ago. And you kind of have to be prepared for that stuff too, because I feel like a lot of it isn't necessarily intuitive.
Well, that's another bit of value that the appellate lawyer brings, is having a previous working knowledge of what kinds of orders are subject to interlocutory appeal. We pay attention to those things whenever the legislature makes any changes to CPRC section 51.014, because we like to pursue appeals or oppose them. Sometimes I think the trial lawyers who are practicing in certain areas, TCPA is the best example, it just sort of occupied civil litigation for about a decade, it seems like. They're going to know about it generally, but they might not know the nuances of it that someone like you would bring to that. It is an advantage, I think, to have an appellate practitioner on the team there, just to have that sort of knowledge about what's appealable, what might stand a decent shot at a mandamus if you have to go there fairly early in the case.
Yeah, another area that's really ripe for interlocutory appeals is in med mal cases on the Chapter 74 reports. You know, once those things are filed, defense will file a motion to dismiss because an inadequate Chapter 74 report, trial court denies it, you got an interlocutory appeal right there. So at that stage, we will be heavily involved with trial counsel working on those Chapter 74 reports.
Which really comes up pretty fast after the suit's filed.
Oh, yeah. Because you got to have those Chapter 74 reports served. I can't remember. It's like 120 days. I can't remember what the deadline is. I think it's...
If y'all are doing a fair amount of that work, I mean, it seems like you'd have to develop a pretty good working knowledge of the medical issues because, yeah, you got that right. The defense has that right to a statutory interlocutory appeal, but the amount of damages are at stake in those cases. We've got the damages caps that influence the economics of those matters. Seems like you'd really have to be able to handle those efficiently to do that as any significant part of your practice.
And we've gotten pretty efficient with it, not only because we had so many of them, so we had to get efficient with it, but there's certain people in my firm that have more medical knowledge than others. And so they're kind of tasked with understanding the medicine, the science, the medical terminology more so than some others. So yeah, we've got kind of a system worked up for those.
So as you move toward trial and getting ready for trial, preparing for trial, how does your focus shift? What do you start to look at then?
So in preparation for trial, one thing that I will do, let's say I'm hired up for trial. I'll also get any motions in limine prepared by either side. And look, we all know motions in limine don't preserve anything per se, but there's a lot of briefing on some issues that go on in those motions in limine. And when trial judges rule on those, even though they know it's not a legal ruling that is subject to review on appeal, when they make those rulings, sometimes they kind of forecast for the trial counsel and the appellate counsel where that judge is leaning. And so it helps you understand, look, if the trial judge is granting a motion limine on this particular issue, we've got to make sure with regard to that piece of evidence that we have everything squared away. So when we get to trial, we can present the court with the right law and ask the witness the right questions to then be able to approach the bench and say, look, here's why this evidence comes in now. So I'll look at motions in limine, and then I'll sit down with my trial counsel and say, look, what are big evidentiary issues that you see that are going to come up during this trial? Let's go ahead and get our arms around those now. And oftentimes what we'll do is we'll prepare trial briefs, bench briefs on that evidentiary issue and have it already done prior to trial. So that when we get to trial and it's time for that evidence to be offered, I can just hand to opposing counsel and hand to the judge and say, hey, here's our bench brief on that evidentiary issue.
Yeah, we did a lot of that in the case I was involved in trying back in December. It made a huge difference, especially when the opposing party did not have that level of support. Having that kind of preparation and the other side sort of being on their heels, I think, impacted the court's approach to those issues. And so it's just another instance in which that advanced preparation can really pay off.
Another thing that I look at, as a matter of fact, we're looking at it right now because we've got a trial coming up here in February, is whether we've got to file any pretrial motions related to equalization of jury strikes or realigning the parties for presentation of that case before the jury. I mean, those are things that need to be done, obviously, before voir dire. So we've got to get those briefed and get those rulings done before trial starts.
You mentioned having a trial coming up, and here we are 2 years into the pandemic. We've talked about it many times. You know, the pandemic was great for Jody and I from the perspective of we had time to start a podcast, and we've talked about it a lot in relation to how justice has proceeded or not proceeded during these times. But what are you seeing in terms of cases going to trial? Have you seen them back in person mostly at this point, or are you working on any virtual jury trials?
So I haven't had any virtual jury trials, but during the pandemic, I had a ton of obviously Zoom hearings, even dispositive MSJs and things like that. A lot of pretrial hearings by Zoom. Throughout the pandemic, I didn't have one in-person trial until this trial that Jody and I had the week before Thanksgiving. That was the first in-person trial I had. So we've got this case coming up in Houston, you know, first week of February, and it may get, I don't know if it's going to start the first week or get postponed a week or whatever. A lot of it depends on what county you're in. I mean, I was seeing some emails just yesterday of attorneys that were up in Collin County, and you wouldn't think the pandemic touched Collin County at all. I mean, the courtroom, the courts were packed. They were having in-person voir dires. They were, you know, not many people were masked up. It kind of depends on what county you're in. Dallas is fairly shut down. I saw an email today about San Antonio trials being postponed. So I didn't know how the pandemic was going to affect our practice with cases not going to trial. It ended up not affecting it very much because we still had plenty of work. Because usually, me personally, I'm in trial probably 5-6 times a year. My firm is in trial a dozen times a year outside of a global pandemic. We'll see what happens as we come out of this Omicron variant.
One of the things you talked about in your paper that I think is interesting is you talk about your trial box. You want to talk a little bit about what that is and what you do with it?
The appellate football.
The appellate football, that's right.
I've got this list. And, you know, by the way, I probably should mention on here, you know, this is a paper I presented at the appellate CLE. I'm presenting it in Dallas for the Dallas Bar Association in February. To the extent I can share this paper, I think I can, but if I can, if anybody wants to reach out to me, I'm happy to share it. What Jody mentioned, this one section in the paper where it talks about trial box, you know, I've got usually have two boxes with me, and they have all the books I need and all the resources I need to be able to do my job for my trial counsel. And just to rattle off a few things, you know, I've got the Rules of Civil Procedure, the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, an annotated book on the Rules of Evidence. The PJC, even though I've got the PJC downloaded to my computer, I still take the relevant PJC book. One of the things I always take with me is a recent CLE paper on error preservation, because as familiar as I am with error preservation, there are some very technical parts of trial that it's good to refresh my memory on right before we get to that point, like during voir dire or during jury charge and things like that. So I always take an error preservation paper, any substantive law books that I need. And then I have a trial notebook that my legal assistant puts together that's got all the live pleadings, motions in limine, any trial briefing on legal issues we know are going to be coming up, working drafts of the jury charge, and then any cases that I'm going to be using for any of those things, I make sure I have them in triplicate for me, for opposing counsel, for the judge, and I've got all the relevant language highlighted. The last thing that I make sure I have in my trial box, this is just very practical stuff, post-it notes, paper clips, binder clips, an extension cord to make sure I can keep all my devices plugged in and charged up while we're in trial. And thank goodness, this trial that Jody and I were recently in, my legal assistant threw some Band-Aids in there. And yeah, who would have thought? I didn't think I needed Band-Aids, but sure enough, I wore a blister on from one of my dress shoes and I had to use the Band-Aids and they just helped out. But you know, you got to think about those kind of stuff. And then also snacks, breakfast bars, something like that. Because as we all know, you know, we're in trial sometimes and either lunch hadn't been thought of or provided for, or sometimes we're working through lunch. And sometimes it's good to just have some type of candy bar or something just to get you through until the evening. So those are the kind of things that I have in my appellate football, and I just wheel them in on my dolly every day and got them sitting right next to me. They also, if there's not enough room at trial counsel table, a lot of times there is. So I'm sitting next to trial counsel and help them out. But if there's not, if you have your two boxes sitting next to you, you can also serve as a little workstation, a little desk there.
You know, it's been a long time since you've had an in-person trial. If you start wearing blisters with your dress shoes, you hadn't had to wear them. That's the benefit of Zoom hearings. You don't have to wear your dress shoes.
That's right.
I love that appellate football. It's kind of just like a mobile office. You've got everything you need right there. So now we're in the sort of the meat of the trial. And there's a couple of sort of critical phases where that appellate lawyer can really make a difference. We've talked some of the pretrial phases in which that can happen, but you know, at trial, I think you already mentioned voir dire, and we've talked a little about the jury charge, but the charge certainly at trial is a different animal than it is pretrial. But there are a few other things worth pointing out during trial. What are some of the key tips you might offer?
One thing I would say, just to back up a little bit about voir dire, the steps to preserving air in voir dire are very technical. And before I got heavily involved in doing litigation support work for trial attorneys, I rarely saw anybody do it right. If you're going to preserve air on strikes for cause, there are very specific steps that you have to walk through to do that. And if you miss a step, it's not preserved. There are some very specific steps with Batson challenges. That's one of the things that right before voir dire, I will review that error preservation paper, make sure I've got those steps directly in mind. Sometimes I'll draft out a script of what I know I need to say to make sure I'm covering each of those points. But we've had cases that have been that voir dire was the issue on appeal. And so it's important to make sure error is being preserved appropriately there and the record's being preserved appropriately. We're in voir dire, and a lot of times, as we know, trial counsel's asking the panel questions and getting a bunch of answers, but not naming those individuals by number. Well, that creates a problem when you can't identify who the juror was if that's going to be an issue on appeal. So it's a very technical part, and it's also a very stressful time because, think about it, voir dire oftentimes takes all day. Or, you know, you start at noon and you're going until the evening. So you get down, it's 6, 7 o'clock at night. Everybody just wants to get out of there. The jurors want to get out of there. The judge wants to get out of there. Everybody's tired. And then all of a sudden, you're like, hey, judge, I'm the big bad appellate counsel here. I've got to walk through these steps of preserving error on strikes for cause. I got to walk through this Batson challenge. And some judges, you know, will be a little bit irritated about having to tackle those issues late at night when everybody's wanting to leave. But most judges that I raise those issues in front of are very receptive to it because they know that we're trying to create and preserve a record. So anyway, it's a stressful time and it's fast-paced and it's late and it's tiring. The next probably most complicated area is a charge conference. Some of the practical things I mentioned in this paper about charge conference, obviously we know that most of the work is done in informal charge conference. So it's not on the record, nothing's preserved. You're going through different drafts of the jury charge and they're flying around. You got drafts all over the table. Every time you're done with a draft and a new draft comes out, take a red pen and put a big X on the prior draft. So you know this is not the draft we're looking at anymore. And that's important. It sounds kind of elementary, but it's important because you need to always make sure you're working with the most recent draft. And anyway, so, you know, you go through informal charge conference, you know how the judge is generally going to rule at formal charge conference. So we go through the steps of either offering and objecting, all the stuff, the hoops that we jump through to make sure we're preserving error in the jury charge or preserving our issues. But this is the practice that I would give people with regard to the jury charge. Once all that's done, formal charge conference is done, this charge is being read to the jury. Your job as an appellate attorney is not over. Your last opportunity to preserve anything, any error, anything wrong with that jury charge is before the jury is discharged. And I can tell you 5 or 6 times I've been in trial. And as the judge is reading the charge. I'm looking at the charge word for word, reviewing what the judge is saying. Trial counsel's not doing that. Trial counsel's focusing on their closing argument. And so I'm going through word for word as the judge reads it. And there's been 5 or 6 times when either I realized there was an error charge. Like one time the burden had been switched on a question, which was a huge problem. Or there's times when I've just had a judge who was reading through it and they just misread something. Well, if the judge misreads something and it's not what's on my paper, I don't know whether the judge has the right draft. I've got the right draft. I don't know who's got the right draft. And so there's been times if I see that or if I see an error in the charge when us as appellate counsel have to be bold and stand up and say, well, look, up to this point, the juries have never heard my voice before. They don't even know what I'm doing. And then all of a sudden, while they're getting read the charge, I stand up and I say, judge, may we approach? And you approach the court and I've had to deal with those error issues. And sometimes the judge agrees with it and we'll go back and change the charge and reprint it and get it back to the jury and start over again. Or sometimes if the judge just misread something, I say, judge, I need to see your charge because you said something a different way and I need to make sure we had the same draft. So we look, they've got the same draft and they just misread it. So the judge gets back on the bench and says, I'm going to start back over with this question because I misread the sentence, and then they continue on. And it's so important that we as appellate counsel stay on top of that charge through that reading, because in those cases where I've come across an error in the charge, if that charge had gone to the jury, it would have devastated the case because of how it was worded.
I've seen cases where the trial counsel waives the reading because it's just long and the jury's going to have it on paper. And I'm 100% with you. You can't do that because you just never know. One typo can blow it up.
Even in those cases where appellate counsel is not involved in the case or in the trial in any other phase, if nothing else, get somebody to come and look at your charge and get somebody to sit in trial with you while the formal charge conference is going on, because I don't have sufficient brain capacity to think about a closing argument and dealing with charge objections and readings at the same time. And I think counsel are so frequently concerned about making their last opportunity to speak to the jury until after the verdict comes in. And they should be. You know, trial lawyers are doing what they do best when they talk to the jury. The charge is so fraught with potential error and just bad things that can happen. And that's one area where I'd certainly encourage trial lawyers to be open to getting somebody to come in and look at the charge and assist with preservation if they do nothing else.
I was just going to say it is so technical in Texas practice how to do it, and one error blows it up.
I had one attorney that called me. They were in trial, and I don't prefer when they're in trial for them to just call me and say, hey, we should need to come down and handle the charge, because I'm like, I don't know what this case is about.
Right.
They called me to come down from the charge conference. I'm literally walking into the courtroom and I say, what's this case about, y'all? And they hand me the live pleadings and I'm sitting there flipping through, oh, this is a truck wreck case. I had no idea what the case was about. And so I came in there, and I don't know if the judge much appreciated me coming in there at that point and starting to argue issues in the charge, not having any familiarity with the case, but, you know, I gave it my best shot. Last point I was going to make about, and this is sort of a charge issue, is that an appellate counsel doesn't necessarily have to be in the courtroom for this, but it's somewhat helpful. When the jury's been discharged, inevitably they're going to come up with questions, and they send questions out. And the judge looks at them, trial counsel looks at them, both sides look at them, and they got to come up with a response. And those responses can be as technical or as important as the charge, because the judge will type it out, make sure everybody is in agreement with it, or if people aren't in agreement with it, you got to preserve error with regard to that answer that the trial court gives. Like I said, I mean, you could be back in your office and the trial counsel called and said, hey, here's what the jury asked, here's what the judge proposed, and what are your thoughts? But I always like appellate counsel on the trial team. I like to be there through deliberations because you just never know what's going to happen. Not only do you not know what's going to happen, but there are another good reason it's good to be there through deliberations and through when the verdict is being read, is because there have been a couple of times when there was an issue with regard to how the jury answered the question. Maybe there were conflict in the answers and we have to send the jury back. And it's good to have an appellate attorney there saying, yes, we need to send the jury back, so we have to clean this issue up. Or if it's unclear how they answer and you got to poll the jury, you know, those are error preservation issues. And so it's good to have an appellate counsel to be there through verdict.
Well, okay. So the trial is over, but the work is not done necessarily. We're kind of coming to the end of not only our discussion, but also the phases of the case before you get to appeal. And we see in Texas practice, post-trial, post-verdict being extremely important for a couple of things, namely error preservation and also timing of any notice of appeal, because of the documents that you file post-trial can make the difference between something being due, you know, 30 days after the judgment is signed or 90 days after the judgment is signed. And of course, we see this is also another point at which it's fairly frequent that appellate counsel gets called for the first time when a lawyer on the other side has moved for JNOV and we've got someone on trying the case who is concerned about what they're seeing in a JNOV. So tell us about how you recommend appellate lawyers approach these sorts of issues post-trial.
So, you know, you're generally going to have JNOVs, you're going to have motions for new trial, obviously preserving different things, motions for new trial for factual sufficiency issues, and JNOVs for legal sufficiency issues or other legal issues, or just, you know, other post-trial motions, JNOV, or if you have a bench trial, you know, you may have findings of fact, conclusions of law, and then also the motion for judgment. At that point, you've got to figure out all the jury's answers and how those affect the recovery, you know, based on percentage of responsibility that's assessed against the plaintiff or whatever, or damage caps and things like that. So briefing the judgment can be pretty legally intensive with regard to those issues. Now, when it comes to JNOVs and motions for new trial, and when we're talking about legal and factual sufficiency of the evidence, what I normally do is I create a skeleton response that, you know, sets forth JNOV standards, set forth motion for new trial standards and things like that. And then whatever the other side has challenged, you know, I may make a heading for those particular elements that they've challenged. And then I'll tell my trial counsel, I'm like, look, this is your case. You're familiar with the facts more than I am. Yes, I was sitting there through trial, but I missed half a day of trial because I was out in the library working on the jury charge or something like that. Even though I was here in trial, I still don't know all the evidence like you do. So here's the skeleton outline for the response. Now I need you to plug in the evidence. And, you know, at this point, you generally don't have a record. You don't have a reporter's record. And so you're not generally having to cite page and line to someone's testimony or documents. I mean, sometimes you can reference specific exhibits because you know what exhibit numbers they are. But I just tell trial counsel, I say, look, plug in your case, plug in the summary of your case, particularly on these issues, and then we'll file it. And then when we get down to arguing it, if it's fact intensive, then I'll have trial counsel argue the fact intensive stuff. If there's some legal issue, then take the legal issue. But I kind of divide up the responsibilities based on whether they're fact driven or legal issue driven.
It does feel kind of funny sometimes to tell the court in writing what the evidence was when you don't have that record to look at.
Yeah, it is.
Trust us, Judge. So-and-so testified to X. It was undisputed.
I seem to recall someone saying such and such. Obviously, those are important issues. And then the next step is just making sure you're getting notice of appeal filed and done correctly the right way, and which is going to, like you said, deadlines are going to be affected by anything that's filed post-trial. Or, and then, you know, when the case then gets up on appeal, that's when we really take over. I'm always consulting with my trial counsel as I'm filing briefs and things like that to make sure I've represented everything correctly. But at that point, that's when I take over lead and court appeals. And unless there's some reason, and occasionally there is a reason why the trial counsel, they'll obviously stay on the briefs, but if there's a reason why trial counsel needs to be lead on it in the appellate court, then we'll take over.
This has all been great stuff, but we're kind of coming up to the end of our time. You've given so many great tips, but we just want to give you a chance. If there's anything we haven't touched on, or if you have a war story or anything you want to share, we kind of do that towards the end of our recordings.
I mean, I sprinkled some of the war stories throughout the thing, but you know what I would encourage appellate counsel to do? Look, appellate work is great. I call the appellate world, you know, it's the world of rainbows and unicorns. You know, we're happy. We're not confrontational. You know, the biggest issues I have with my opposing counsel is, hey, can I get a 30-day extension? Yeah, no problem. You know, I mean, those are the issues. It's a great world to live in. There's no doubt. We're not fighting over documents. We're not fighting over witnesses. You know, I mean, I've literally have seen trial counsel nearly come to blows in the courtroom. And, you know, we don't do that. We're nice folks. And so as fun as the appellate world is, researching and writing briefs and arguing the court appeals, if you have an opportunity, mix your practice up and be able to do that appellate stuff in the trial courtroom, because it's really a lot of fun to get in the trial courtroom and get in front of a jury. Even though I'm not putting witnesses on, even though I'm not offering the evidence, it's fun to mix an appellate practice up with litigation support at the trial level. It's just a lot of fun. So I would encourage people, get out of the appellate courtroom, get out of the library, whatever libraries are these days, and get into the trial courtroom with your trial counsel and have fun doing it.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, same. Great advice. Well, Kirk, thanks for being with us. We sure appreciate your time.
You bet. Well, I'm glad. Thank y'all for having me, and it's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.